This archival recording is part of a tribute to Michael Parenti, the internationally known political scientist, historian, and activist. TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, the JFK assassination and the gangster nature of the state. This is the second part of a one-hour talk by Michael Parenti that caused a controversy in the media when it was first aired on the occasion of the 30th anniversary of the JFK assassination. In part one, Parenti spoke on the question whether government agencies of a democratic country would do such a thing as assassinate an American president. Michael Parenti explained what he meant by the title of his talk, The Gangster Nature of the State. The political economist Max Weber once said that the state has a monopoly on the use of force and violence. And that monopoly of power has been used to defend the power structure within that state. Adam Smith was just one of many economists who candidly said, "As the distribution of property becomes more unequal, we more and more need the state to defend those who have property from those who do not." End quote. Parenti sees in the JFK assassination not just the violent death of an individual, but says if the truth about the events were known, it would call into question the entire state system and the social order it represents. End quote. And that troubling implication is probably the reason why the mainstream press has suppressed the research of those who investigated the circumstances of Kennedy's death. In his investigation, Parenti had focused on the troubling contradictions in Lee Harvey Oswald's life. In part one, Parenti went through Oswald's defection to the USSR and his public statements there about passing on military secrets, and his return to the U.S., no questions asked, with the State Department paying for his travel and moving expenses. Now he explains how Oswald is building a leftist identity, Michael Parenti.
Once back in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald settles in under the wing of one George Demorenschild, a right-wing Russian with CIA ties. And this begins a whole pattern that goes on in Dallas and New Orleans, namely, forays out into the public eye as a leftist. He starts a one-person Fair Play for Cuba organization in New Orleans, never has another member, never recruits another member. All his time in New Orleans and in Dallas, he never once contacts a single member of the Communist Party or any other left organization. Although he writes lots of letters to the Communist Party USA and to the Socialist Workers Party, two groups which at that time weren't even talking to each other. Say, "Dear comrades, how are you? We fight forward and we go on. Yes, what should I do?" And this and that. Send me instructions, you know. He blazes a trail, local TV, fistfights, inflammatory incidents, leaflets. One of the leaflets shows that his organization was on Camp Street in the very same building that Guy Bannister had his office. Guy Bannister was an FBI agent, and a whole bunch of other Cuban emigre right-wing groups were there. And his personal relations were with right-wing anti-communist Cubans or with right-wing crypto-fascists or CIA types or others. So while he supposedly was this leftist, and if you ever heard any of the tapes of him speaking and explaining what communism was or socialism was, it's laughable. It's this little rote, superficial thing. While he was a leftist, in fact, all his personal associations were with right-wing people linked to the intelligence community. He also knew Jack Ruby. Now, they would have us believe that this man who couldn't hit the side of the barn took a Manlinka Carcana rifle whose sights were not even set. An Italian weapon, by the way, which the Italians said, the weapon that never killed anyone on purpose. And he fired and killed the President of the United States. that he would forego shooting President Kennedy when he had a full body shot of him coming right at him down Houston Street, right toward the Texas Book Depository, where he could go at him like a shooting gallery that's coming closer and closer. Perfect, the ideal thing. He didn't shoot him then. He waited until the car turned at a 110-degree angle down Elm Street, and as he went by and had only his head and a little portion of his shoulders, and then firing through the trees, he rapidly got off 3 shots in a few seconds, something which the best marksmen in the country were not able to emulate until after much practice and after the sights on the Manlike Carcana were reset and brought into a laboratory and fixed in there. And they had all sorts of remarks to make about the awful performance of this rifle. By the way, right through a tree that was later cut down. We are asked to believe that a bullet would go through John Kennedy, pose in midair for 2 seconds, change directions, and wound Governor Connally in 2 places, and then reappear intact on a stretcher fallen out of Connally's body. By the way, that's not true. It did not ever reappear on the stretcher as if fallen out of somebody's body. It had reappeared wedged into the side of the stretcher. It obviously had been pushed in there. So this was a bullet that jumped out of Connally's body and wedged itself in the side of the stretcher. This magic bullet had a lot of magic in it. We're asked to believe that a treasure of physical evidence, the interior of the limousine, the presidential limousine itself, which would have all sorts of evidence, bits of shrapnel, whatever else, from bullet parts, blood, lines of fire, which was just accidentally taken, instantly torn out, destroyed, and totally rebuilt, that this was not a deliberate cover-up. But we're asked to believe that Kennedy's brain just disappeared, that the x-ray, which now shows a reconstructed head with no exit wound, is oddly taken with no jaw. So it could be anybody's. You can't do any kind of dental identification to see if that x-ray is President Kennedy's. That the autopsy was just botched innocently. We're asked to believe that Jack Ruby, a gambler and gangster with links to the Cuban exiles and an acquaintance of Oswald's, who once worked for Congressman Richard Nixon for the House and American Activities Committee in Chicago when his name was still Jack Rubenstein, before he changed it to Ruby, were asked to believe that he just took it upon himself to kill Oswald because he was so moved by the suffering that Oswald had caused the Kennedy family. Although Ruby, a year later in jail, repeatedly kept alluding to the fact that you don't know the whole story. There's much more behind all of this. There's something really deep and sinister here and all this. And he was just simply dismissed by a media that was taking its cues. We're asked that the 21 witnesses, persons otherwise related to the case in some close way, with some information, privy to some conversations, whatever else, all who've met violent deaths were part of a colossal coincidence, like the one the Washington Post was talking about. That later on in 1978, the second round of killings that started after the House Select Committee investigation, 16 more who died violently, they just happened to die coincidentally, violent deaths, including one of them being George de Morenchild himself, killed by a gun blast to the head 3 hours after a House Assassinations Committee investigator had tried to contact him. He was being set up for an interview. He was being set up for a lot more than that. George Morenchild was not only close to Oswald, but in his telephone book there was found an insert to George Pappy Bush, that he was a close friend of George Bush, and there was a correspondence between them. The sheriff's office in Palm County, Florida, found that his shooting was very strange, and it was ruled a suicide. William Sullivan, a third guy in the FBI, who was supposed to appear before the House committee to talk. By the way, Sullivan was on CIA, according to Robert Murrow, he was on the CIA payroll. He was shot right outside his home by a man who claimed to have mistaken him for a deer. He was charged with misdemeanor and released in custody of his father, a state policeman. Sam Giancano, who died from natural causes when his heart stopped beating after a bullet went through it. One day before he was to testify about mob and CIA connections, while under government protection. And by the way, what comes out of this whole thing is the incredible linkages between the CIA and mob families and mob figures again and again. Because after all, the mob is very functional. They can do the kind of dirty things that the CIA may sometimes want them to do. There are even some on the left, like Noam Chomsky and Alexander Coburn, who argue that this whole interest in the assassination comes from a Kennedy revival, a Camelot yearning, the yearning for a lost Messiah. I'm giving quotes. These are quotes right from Chomsky. Coburn and Chomsky and others, they challenge the notion that Kennedy was assassinated for intending to withdraw from Vietnam or undo the CIA or end the Cold War. These things could not have led to his downfall because they were not true. Kennedy was a Cold Warrior, a counterinsurgent who wanted a military withdrawal from Vietnam only with victory. I have argued similarly in my book, Democracy for the Few, that in fact, indeed, Kennedy was a Cold Warrior and a counterinsurgent, and that he should not be romanticized as a progressive. Chomsky, Coburn, and others claim that the change of administration that came with JFK's assassination had no large-scale effect on policy, not even on tactics. In other words, if Kennedy had lived, he likely would have fabricated a Tonkin Gulf casus belli. He would have introduced ground troops in a massive land war, as Lyndon Johnson did. He would have engaged in the merciless B-52 carpet bombings of Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, as Richard Nixon did. He would have risked destroying his own electoral base, proving himself a mass murderer as bad as Nixon. Chomsky and Coburn don't tell us how they know that. All we know is the one surviving Kennedy, the Robert Kennedy, in fact, went a different way. He became an anti-war critic, he opposed the war, he broke with the Johnson administration, and he said that his brother's administration, his administration, had committed terrible mistakes. The evidence we do have, in fact, is that John Kennedy observed Cambodian neutrality and negotiated a ceasefire and coalition government in Laos, which the CIA refused to honor. They preferred to back a right-wing faction that continued the war. Chomsky says much about troop withdrawal. He just wrote a whole book on this, Camelot Revisited and all that. But he says very little about troop escalation, other than to offer Roger Hilsman's speculation that Kennedy might well have introduced U.S. troops, ground troops in South Vietnam. Maybe so, maybe not. In fact, the same Hilsman noted in the New York Times not long ago, and Chomsky doesn't note it, that in 1963, Kennedy was the only person in his administration who opposed the introduction of U.S. ground troops. He was the only thing preventing an escalation of the war. Forget the question of withdrawal or not withdrawal. He was a barrier in that sense. Whether or not there are certain left analysts who think Kennedy was or wasn't a progressive or a liberal and thinks that the CIA had no reason to kill him or other people had no reason to be dissatisfied him, the fact is, do they see it that way? You know, entrenched interests are notorious for not seeing the world the same way that left analysts do. In 1963, people in right-wing circles, including elements in various intelligence organizations, did not believe that Kennedy could be trusted with the nation's future. Now, some months ago on a San Francisco talk show, I heard a guy come on. It was on KGO, and he said, "I've never said this before. I never said it. It's the first time I'm saying it. But I worked for Army Intelligence. And in 1963, I was in Japan, and when the accepted word around then was that Kennedy would be killed because he was messing too much with the intelligence community. And when word came of his death, we were, all I could hear were delighted comments like, 'We got the bastard.'" What JFK's enemies saw something was what they saw was something different from what Chomsky and Coburn have seen. They fixed on Kennedy's refusal to provide air coverage, the Bay of Pigs, his refusal to go in with U.S. forces, his unwillingness to launch another invasion of Cuba, his no invasion guarantee to Khrushchev on Cuba, his atmospheric test ban treaty with Moscow, his American University speech calling for a reexamination of our Cold War attitudes toward the Soviet Union, his unwillingness to send ground forces in a massive form into Vietnam, his antitrust suit against General Electric, his fight with U.S. Steel over price increases, his challenge to the Federal Reserve Board, his warm reception at labor conventions, his call for racial equality and responsiveness to civil rights leaders, reluctant responsiveness, his talk of moving forward in a new frontier. Erwin Knoll, the progressive, says that he admits he has no idea who killed Kennedy, but this doesn't keep him from asserting that the Oliver Stone film was manipulative and that Stone provided false answers. How do you know that, Erwin, if you have no idea who killed Kennedy? And the remarkable thing about Erwin Knoll and Noam Chomsky and Alexander Coburn is they don't know a damn thing about the criticisms and investigation that's been made. We've said this again and again. In the rebuttals in the exchange in the Nation, almost every one of them said, Alexander Coburn doesn't know anything about this case. He doesn't know anything about Lee Harvey Oswald, really. He doesn't know just some of the questions I brought up. They don't know anything. And they never deny it. They never say anything. They go on with their patronizing comments. Well, Chomsky, patronization and condescension. Coburn, with vitriol and venom. They go on attacking those who supposedly are idealizing Kennedy. Erwin Knoll shows he's flexible, though. He says he allows that the Warren Commission did a hasty, slipshod job of investigation. I disagree. The commission did a brilliant job of investigation. It sat for 51 long sessions over a period of several months, much longer than most major investigations. It compiled 26 volumes of testimony and evidence. It had the investigative resources of the FBI and CIA at its command. Far from being hasty and slipshod, it painstakingly crafted theories that moved toward its foreordained conclusion that Oswald was the assassin. It framed an argument and moved unfailingly to fulfill that argument. It failed to call witnesses who saw something different from what it wanted to hear, who not only heard, but who saw people on the grassy knoll shooting. It failed to call them. It ignored or reinterpreted what little conflicting testimony that did creep into its proceedings. All this took deliberate effort. It was carefully crafted, painstakingly. A hasty, slipshod investigation would show traces of randomness in its errors. Some would go this way, some would go that way. But the commission's distortions consistently move in the same direction in pursuit of a prefigured hypothesis. The gullible U.S. public that Erwin Knoll talks about. Knoll condemns Oliver Stone for playing on the gullibility of the American people. See, he's not gullible. He's cool. He doesn't fall for this. He's so cool he didn't even go see the movie. You see, the U.S. public has not bought the official explanation. 78% say they believe there was a conspiracy. And both Chomsky and Coburn in The Nation, Chomsky in Z Magazine, and again in a letter in exchange with me, both of them dismiss that fact and point out the same identical analog. They point out that, in fact, over 70% of the people also believe in miracles. So, what does that prove? And what has that got to do with the question at hand? That people can have a stupid opinion about one thing doesn't mean they're stupid about everything. In fact, Chomsky and Coburn are themselves evidence of that. In any case, the comparison is between two different things. They're comparing the public's gullibility about miracles with the public's unwillingness to be gullible about the official line of it being fed and shoved in their faces for 30 years. That's not gullibility at all. Alexander Coburn and Noam Chomsky have told us that we must not reduce great developments in history to conspiracy, for then we lose sight of institution, class, and other systemic factors of American capitalism. I don't need them to tell me about systemic factors in American capitalism. I use a structural analysis in all my writings. But investigating the JFK conspiracy, we are not looking for an escape from something unpleasant and difficult. That's psychiatrist Noam Chomsky speaking. But we're hitting upon the nature of state power in what is supposedly to be a democracy. Conspiracy is not something that's in contradistinction to structural analysis. It is part of it. These guys will use conspiracy. They will use legitimacy. They will finance elections. They will use publicity campaigns. They will set up liberalish organizations. They will set up alternative trade union movements. They will use assassins and death squads. They will use every single conceivable thing there is. And this was one of the things they used. When they had someone who was giving them trouble, when they had someone who was standing in their path because he was a little too bright and too shiny, when they had an agenda to save Southeast Asia from communism, they would kill one of their own. And that is a tremendous revelation. It was a startling revelation to the American public to make them realize what kind of a gangster government and national security state we really have in this country and what it does around the world. A structuralist position should not discount the role of human agency in history. Institutions are not self-generating forces. The great continuities of corporate and class interests, that's Coburn's phrase, do not happen of their own accord like reified, disembodied social forces. Neither empires nor national security institutions come into existence in a fit of absent-mindedness. Although the British elites used to say that, the British Empire was accumulated in a fit of absent-mindedness. Give me a break, as these guys plotted and killed and brought armies in and destroyed and bribed and murdered and lied and did all the things and plundered these countries and plundered them. Absent-minded? God knows when you focus your attention what you would do. There's a conscious interest being pursued here, and the evidence for it is the state itself. These things, these events, are created by willfully intended policymakers who pursue specific interests. It is the essence of the state and the function of state institutions to act as conscious agents in recreating the conditions of politico-economic hegemony. That's what it's there for. That's what they're paid to do. To achieve their goals, state leaders, especially those within the national security state, will resort to every necessary form of mass manipulation, deception, and violence, even against one of their own, whom they have come to see as a liability. Conspiratorial action is not, brothers and sisters, is not something separate and exclusive of institutional presence. In fact, there's a constant interplay between the two. And by the way, this call for constructual analysis, institutional analysis, where's the institutional analysis in the nation? All you get are conspiracies, inside intrigues, events, happenings, articles that preoccupy with immediate policies, issues, events, personalities, secret deals, all that kind of stuff. All of them of vastly lesser magnitude than JFK assassination. And yet, in 30 years, the nation and the progressive have never published a single word by investigators like Peter Dale Scott and such, except a letter to the editor once in a while. Now, let me quote from Peter's book, Deep Politics. He raises this question of conspiracy, and he points out that G. William Domhoff makes a point very much like Coburn's. He says, and Peter, I think, makes a point very much like the one I made, in which I was quoting from, which was in my exchange with Chomsky and Z Magazine, about, and also with Chomsky, and also in The Nation, in my exchange with Coburn, I made this point that conspiracy and institution are not mutually exclusive. And they never have answered or addressed that point, either to rebut it or to accept it or to see how it doesn't apply here or does apply, whatever. They just ignore it. Domhoff points out, if conspiracy means that these men, meaning the ruling elites, are aware of their interests, know each other personally, meet together privately and off the record, and try to hammer out a consensus on how to anticipate and react to events and issues, then there is some conspiring that goes on in the Council for Foreign Relations, not to mention the Committee for Economic Development, the Business Council, the National Security Council, and the Central Intelligence Agencies. But then Domhoff, Scott goes on to show that Domhoff shares that same kind of resistance that Coburn and Chomsky have to the idea that an assassination conspiracy could have a lasting impact on our political arrangements. We all have a tremendous tendency to want to get caught up in believing that there's some secret evil cause for all of the obvious ills of the world. Conspiracy theories encourage a belief that if we get rid of a few bad people, everything will be well in the world. He's quoting Domhoff. Then Peter answers, I believe that a true understanding of the Kennedy assassination will lead not to a few bad people, but to the institutional and parapolitical arrangements which constitute the way we are systematically governed. The conspiracies I see as operative, in other words, are part of our political structure, not exceptions to it. That's Peter Dale Scott. What the left critics do is that they mistake the low political value of the victim, JFK, whom they hate and detest. Their big fear is that you're going to like him. With the high political importance of the issue and the implications for democracy, the revelation of the gangster nature of the state. I mean, Captain Alfred Dreyfus, back in 1894, was a conservative militarist. Clemenceau once conjectured that if his name had not been Dreyfus, he would have been an anti-Dreyfusard. Does that mean that the political struggle waged in L'Affaire Dreyfus was a waste of time? The issue was quickly drawn between the right and the left, between those who stood with the army and those who stood with the Republic itself and with justice. The same with Benigno Aquino. Aquino was a member of the privileged class in the Philippines. He promised no great structural changes. He was even more conservative than Kennedy. Does this mean that the Filipino people should have dismissed the conspiracy that led to his assassination as an event of no experience? Say, oh, just another ruling class pig. What do we care? Instead, they used it as ammunition against the hated Marcos regime, as a revelation of what that government was really doing. Archbishop Romero of El Salvador, he was a member of the Salvadoran aristocracy. He could not have made it to the top of the church hierarchy otherwise. When he was ordained, they came with presents. They hugged and kissed him. And the minute he opened up his mouth and made some critical remarks and about the war and some favorable remarks about the poor, he was assassinated. I doubt if he hadn't been assassinated, the Salvadoran history would have been much different. Does this mean that solidarity groups in this country and in El Salvador should not have tried to make his murder an issue that revealed the homicidal gangster nature of the Salvadoran state? Instead of seizing the opportunity, some left writers condescendingly ascribe a host of mass psychology motivations and emotional needs to those of us who are concerned about the JFK assassination. They psychologize about our illusions, our false dreams, our longings for messiahs and father figures, our inability to face unpleasant realities the way they can. They deliver patronizing admonitions about our conspiracy captivation and Camelot yearnings. They urge us not to escape into fantasy. They are the cognoscenti who guide us and outleft us on the JFK assassination, a subject about which they don't know a goddamn thing and whose significance they will never be able and have not been able to grasp. I have a different name for our interests. It is not JFK worship. It's not Camelot yearnings, as the left critics would say. It's not big evils and conspiracy titillation, as the mainstream media would say. Our interest is born of democratic struggle, a desire to know what is going on, a desire to have rulers who are worthy of our name and the name of democracy. Thank you.
That was Michael Parenti on the JFK assassination and the gangster nature of the state. With roots in a working-class Italian district of New York and a PhD in political science from Yale, Michael Parenti has become an internationally known lecturer. An extended text of this talk can be found in Parenti's book, Dirty Truth, published by City Lights. Visit TUC Radio's website at tucradio.org for links to Michael Parenti's website. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. This was a tribute to Michael Parenti and his 1993 talk on the JFK assassination. Since then, more books have been published with important additional information. One is The Last Investigation, What Insiders Know About the Assassination of JFK. That's by the congressional researcher Gaetan Fonzi. The other, by James Douglas, is JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. Links are on tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.